week. People power making history, a revolt in the Midwest, and a revolution sweeping across the Middle East. State of Siege, we take you to Wisconsin, where firefighters and teachers have stormed the Capitol, lawmakers are in hiding, and the Tea Party is fighting back. Bob Woodruff with the real stories inside the battle in the heartland.
We won in November. Elections have consequences.
Our roundtable will ask, will this spread around the rest of the country? As cuts get deep, who should bear the pain? And freedom fever, the very latest from the Middle East, where bloody protests force another key ally to do the unthinkable. My exclusive with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the young internet revolutionaries who tell us how they engineered the fall of America's staunchest ally with American tech, not tanks. This week, People Power starts right now. Good morning. Populist frustration is boiling over this week, as we've said, not just in the Middle East, but in the middle of this country as well. A budget war threatens to shut down the federal government, and now union workers fighting back are tying state and local governments in knots. Ground Zero, Madison, Wisconsin. ABC's Bob Woodruff is there, and he joins me now with the very latest. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Christiane.
So there have been 6 days of protests there so far, state employees fighting the proposed cuts to their benefits and their union's right to bargain, Democratic legislators hiding in order to stop a vote. Bob, what's driving the people that you've met there? Does it look like there's an end in sight?
Well, that's a good question. You know, this has been just a huge event. The weather's now starting to change today. They think there might be about 6 inches of snow today. Hopefully that's going to come to an end as well. But really, the numbers are really impressive. You know, they now estimate that about 68,000 people were here yesterday. Most of them were teacher union members, but also then for the first time yesterday, the Tea Party supporters.
Is this what the future of American politics looks like?
I don't think we've ever had anything like this. This is unprecedented for our times.
In Madison, the Capitol building is still swelling with protesters, a near total takeover.
Our house is the middle of the country.
Tens of thousands in the streets, too, determined to thwart a bill they see as a frontal assault on public labor unions.
What's disgusting?
Union busting!
What's disgusting?
Union busting!
How do you get better teachable moments than this? We don't like what somebody's doing, we don't just sit back and watch. We don't wait 4 years for the next election cycle. We tell them right away we don't like it.
This is what democracy looks like!
The protesters here are furious with Governor Scott Walker's plan to drastically curtail the bargaining power of their unions. Outraged public workers and their allies have dominated the scene here since last Monday. But for the first time this weekend, they had company.
Go, Scott, go! Go, Scott, go! Go, Scott, go!
Really what this is a tale of two rallies. You've got one side, the union on this side.
Kill the bill! Kill the bill!
And then you're coming over here to the Tea Party.
Pass the bill! Pass the bill!
So on one side you got kill the bill, on the sides you got pass the bill.
Go Scott, go! Go Scott, go!
The crowd supporting the governor, smaller in size but not in conviction, came from around the state to deliver a clear message.
We're not going to negotiate. Why would we negotiate? We won in November. Elections have consequences. It's as simple as that. I can't make it any plainer. We won. They lost. That's what's going to happen. The bill's going to be passed.
We met Lou DiBraccio early in the morning, 110 miles away from the Capitol, as he and a clutch of fellow Tea Party supporters boarded a bus bound for Madison. DiBraccio is a small government conservative, eager for his voice to be heard in the debate.
I
want to I want to see the state move forward, and in order to do that, many of us in the private sector have had to sacrifice, and I think necessary that we all share that sacrifice. It does hit home for me. My wife is a teacher. It's going to cost our family money, but it's the right thing to do, so I support it.
While DeBracio was heading to town, chemistry teacher Anthony Schnell and his family were deep in their morning routine.
The immediate effect to our family is that we will make about a $500 a month less on Anthony's paycheck. And we are just hanging on by our fingernails right now. My husband loves to be a teacher. He's tried other things, and he loves education. He loves kids. He loves working with families. And for him to say, I think I might have to leave this again, is just heartbreaking because it's his passion.
This isn't about the money. It's not about the benefits. Of course, that's going to hit us, and we don't like that. But it's really about having input in the classes. You know, having input with the school board, having input with what happens.
Anthony's been coming to the protests all week, but the Tea Party's presence weighed on his mind as he approached the Capitol.
A little nervous about today. I just don't know what's going to happen.
Once inside the rotunda, he lost the butterflies and began working the crowd.
Is this a budget fight?
No!
Is this just about money?
No!
Is this about us doing the best we can in our classrooms?
Yes!
They're all saying this is huge, and if it happens here, it's going to happen everywhere in the rest of the country.
In the rotunda, there is now a flavor of a 60s era sit-in. In fact, some told us it's the biggest demonstration they've seen here since the Vietnam War.
Keep doing this every day until this thing, this bill is killed?
I think this is going to happen every day until this bill is killed. I don't think there's any way that the people in this building are going to give up the right to collective bargaining.
No, I'm here because this is wrong. That this sort of shotgun legislation, ramming it through, is the wrong way to deal with problems. This isn't about me. It's about trying to do the best we can for society and communities.
Do you think it's going to be peaceful?
I think so. I think the tensions are going to be high, but I think it's going to stay civil.
But what if this...
Well, wait.
If
not
this bill
civil,
passes.
It's going to stay peaceful.
Lou DeBracio got an earful from the pro-labor crowd as he made his way to the Tea Party demonstration.
Change any of their minds. They were committed enough to drive here and make signs, just like they're not going to change my mind. It's not about that. So there's limited return in talking to them.
Even some families are divided. Julie Hansen supports the governor. Her 13-year-old daughter does not.
My 13-year-old is for collective bargaining. She went to school yesterday, and the teachers spoke to her about it.
You think she believes it, or just because of that one lesson from the teacher?
We had a pretty adamant discussion.
Jeff Strobel is here with the Tea Party. His brother-in-law is on the other side.
And my brother-in-law is a union worker. We had a big email exchange on Facebook last night. The best thing is it was civil. It was just, you know, courteous. But we kind of tried to educate each other, but we're never going to agree. He's on this side, I'm on this side, but we can talk about it.
Still going to have a peaceful Christmas dinner together?
As long as there's beer there, we'll be peaceful.
Late Saturday, the governor issued a statement turning down a compromise offer from the unions. And so here in Wisconsin, the standoff continues for now. For this week, I'm Bob Woodruff in Madison, Wisconsin.
Some of what I've heard coming out of Wisconsin, where you're just making it harder for public employees to collectively bargain generally, seems like more of an assault on unions. And I think it's very important for us to understand that public employees, they're our neighbors. They're our friends. They make a lot of sacrifices and make a big contribution. And I think it's important not to vilify them or to suggest that somehow all these budget problems are due to public employees.
President Obama igniting a national conversation about which Americans should feel the pain of the budget acts, with pitched battles going on right now here in Washington and in state houses from Florida to Wisconsin to California. With me now, our roundtable, George Will, Congressman Steve Sutherland, a Republican freshman from Florida. He was elected to public office for the very first time last November and sent here to Washington on a mission to cut spending. Also with us, ABC senior political correspondent Jonathan Carl and political strategist Donna Brazil, who calls herself a Labor Democrat. Yes. Thank you all for being here. So, George, Wisconsin, is this the sort of battle that we're going to see shaping up around the country? Is this really the sort of political and philosophical debate that's going on right now about what these cuts are going to mean?
It would have been even if the president hadn't intervened. But in the span of 3 days, Christian, he first submits a budget that would increase the federal deficit, and 2 days later he mobilizes his party, his own political machine, and organized labor, which is an appendage of his party, to sabotage Wisconsin's attempt to do what he will not do, which is deal with the insolvency of their government. In doing so, he has set the stage for 2012 by saying the Democratic Party is the party of government, not just in having an exaggerated view of the scope and competence of government, but because its base is in public employees.
Mm-hmm. So, Donna, mobilizing his troops, sabotaging the effort to cut the budget, he did use the word assault, the president. Is that too much? I mean, what is going on here?
Well, first of all, they're entering day seven of the protest, and my recollection is that President Obama commented on it in day four of the protest. So the fact is that this is a grassroots movement that had nothing to do with people or politicians in Washington, D.C. This has everything to do with the workers there in Wisconsin and all across the country who are feeling the effects of these draconian budget cuts. Look, state and local workers have taken the brunt of a lot of these cuts, and they're willing to come to the table to talk to the governor to put forward more wage cuts, more pension, to pay up more money for their pension, more for their health care. Why won't the governor sit down with them? That's all they want. They want the governor to sit down with them to talk about these items, but they want their collective bargaining right, their voice at the table, removed from the discussion.
Is this a defining moment for the labor movement?
Absolutely. Look, union membership is at an all-time low over the previous 20-year high. This is an assault on workers across the country. And people believe that they're using the pretense of a budget battle to destroy collective bargaining rights.
So, Representative Sutherland, a freshman to this process, is this about fiscal responsibility, or what is happening? Because it's happening in your state as well.
It is. And as you know, with nearly all of the states requiring a balanced budget amendment, they don't have any choice. The governors have to balance their budget. I know our own governor, Governor Scott, we see similar measures being taken in the state of Florida. And I think you're seeing this in New Jersey. You're seeing this in Wisconsin. So I think that because they're bound by that limit of a balanced budget, which I am in favor at the federal level, I think that you're going to see this around the country. The American family is learning they have to do more with less. And the same expectation, I think, is fair of the governments, both state and federal.
And, John, is it just about the budget, or is Madison, Wisconsin, have a bigger political implication?
Oh, it clearly has a bigger political implication. Look, the president was quicker and more forceful in his denouncement of Governor Scott Walker than he was in denouncing Hosni Mubarak. this happened. It was more forceful. It was quicker. Madison, Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin, this is arguably ground zero for the 2012 presidential campaign. Look, this is a state that if President Obama loses, he almost certainly is going to not win re-election. This is a state that's been solidly Democratic and went more in the direction of Republicans, a bigger move than any other state in 2010. Mm-hmm. I mean, look what happened. You saw the Republicans capture the governorship, capture the state legislature, two House seats, a Senate seat, and, Democrats see the momentum and see real danger sides for next year.
Governor Walker was elected promising to do what he's doing. He did the same thing as county executive of Milwaukee, where there were protests, union uprisings, and he was handily reelected. Donna, as I'm sure you know, such heroes of the labor movement as Franklin Roosevelt and Fiolero LaGuardia said, there's no place in the public sector for unionization at all. As I'm sure you know, 24 states limit or deny entirely collective bargaining rights for public sector unions. And all Mr. Scott is planning to do is limit collective bargaining to wages. What is draconian about that?
Well, what these workers would like, George, since they've already given up furloughs, paid leave, unpaid leave, what they would like is to have a voice at the table. They don't want their collective bargaining rights. And look, what we're talking about is that the governor has cherry-picked what public workers he will subject to this so-called removal of their collective bargaining rights. The firefighters, the policemen, and others who supported him in his election bid, well, guess what? They don't have to worry about their collective bargaining rights. Christiane, over 400,000 state and local employees have lost their jobs during the duration of the recession. They are willing, what we've seen across the country is these workers are willing to come to the table to talk to these governors about reducing the budget deficit, but not on the backs of working people.
Let me ask you, because you brought up, George, when the governor was the county executive in Milwaukee, and there's an interesting story today. It boils down, perhaps, as some might say, to sort of shared sacrifice. Where is the sacrifice going to be borne the most, and is it equitable? I just want to ask you, the article talks about the layoffs that the governor had announced back then in 2003, quote, decimated the country's public parks, the staff, reduced the number of county social workers, correction officers, janitors. As a result, park bathrooms shuttered, pools closed, and trash piled up so high. I mean, does it get to a point where too much is too much,
and
or not?
And he's reelected.
That was my next question.
The public liked what he did.
Okay. All right. Well, that's
the
answer.
They liked what he did in one county, but what you see today is an organic movement. Just like the Tea Party went out there and grabbed the microphone, what you have is grassroots people out there saying, no more. No more budget cuts on the back of working people. The governor has proposed tax giveaways to corporations. I know he campaigned on that to give away.
People like Representative Sutherland came here to make those massive cuts.
And let me say this about working people. You know, that's not just federal employees. I mean, I come from a small business. And 40% of the jobs lost in this recession came from small business, which makes up 85% of our economy. So, you know, when I look at the retirement benefits and the benefit packages that most small businesses offer to their employees, and they pale in comparison to many of the federal programs that federal employees have the benefit of. So, you know, I think many people that work in small businesses are depending upon their Social Security as their retirement.
Donna, what you call the grassroots is a tiny minority of this tiny minority of Wisconsin people who work for the government. 300,000 public employees in Wisconsin went to work while the teachers were clutching their little signs that say it's all about the kids, were abandoning their classrooms, lying to their supervisors, saying they were sick, and going off to protest in defense of perquisites, which, if the governor cuts them as much as he plans to do, would still leave them better off than their private sector.
But why should workers bear the brunt of this recession? Why are we scapegoating just public sector employees when, in fact, the folks on Wall Street and others who caused this recession, George, they're enjoying huge bonuses. Bankers are not lending to small businesses, which is why we're not creating the kind of jobs that we need. But we're trying to balance the budgets on the backs of the poor and the middle class, and that's why workers are standing up for their rights.
And do you think, though, that, as some have said, this is just an opportunity for union busting?
Well, I'm not sure if that is the focus. I want to say something about, you know, Donna's comment.
I remember you're a freshman.
No, I remember. I remember. But let me say this.
And I'm your first woman on national TV other than Christiane.
But I'm not a freshman at running our small business. And you talk about bankers lending. You know, community banks are being hammered, you know, because they're coming in, they're being taken over. They can't loan money. Okay, you can't get appraisals. You look at the thrift and how they're coming in and capturing the small banks. And the small banks in our communities are critical to the flavor of our communities. We can't get capital. So I think, and that's a regulation issue.
And that's an issue that Congress should address.
But clearly Walker is going.
I think
we
will.
Walker is going right at the public employee unions. And part of it's because of that experience he had in 2003. He has said that he wouldn't have had to make all those cuts if he could have gotten better deals,
concessions. And it's not just Republican governors. It's some Democrats as well. Mario Cuomo and Absolutely. Others are having
but,
to
But
go.
One of the things he's doing is he's
Andrew.
Saying...
Andrew.
yeah, don't do that. One of the things that he's doing is saying that no longer will union dues be automatically taken out of public employee paychecks. Mm-hmm. So the unions would have to go out and collect those dues. This is something that's going right at the heart, not necessarily of the union employee, but the union leadership.
But the unions want to come to the table. They want to come to the table, George. They got 12%. They say, here, we want to contribute 12%. We want to give you $30 billion for this fiscal year, which ends on June 30th, and over the next 2 years, $300 million in concessions. Now, you don't walk away from the table. You don't come to the bargaining table when labor is ready to negotiate.
Our goal here is to cut spending. When we say we're going to cut spending, read my lips. We're going to cut spending.
House Speaker John Boehner drawing a line in the sand. And sure enough, yesterday, the House, with its Tea Party-powered freshmen, passed the biggest spending cut in modern American history. But now it goes to the Democrat-controlled Senate, and it sets up an epic clash of ideas over how to solve a massive budget crisis. And it sets the stage for a possible government shutdown. Joining me once again, George Will, Congressman Steve Sutherland of Florida, a conservative freshman elected with Tea Party support, Jonathan Carl and Donna Brazil. So, you're a man on Capitol Hill. This was the first shot in this big battle over spending cuts. And really, people like Congressman Sutherland showed their muscle.
This is the Tea Party's moment. I mean, imagine this. We are not talking not only about cutting government spending. I mean, Washington's never really done that. But we're talking about how much. I mean, even the Democrats, even Nancy Pelosi came out with a measure that would continue government funding temporarily, freezing it at last year's level. That is what Democrats traditionally would call a cut, because yes. you're not going with inflation. Mm-hmm. So this is really a moment. This is also the Chris Christie phenomenon. Will politicians be rewarded for making tough choices? Again, something I don't think we've ever seen happen.
Do you care about being rewarded about tough choices?
Well, I think the American people are ready. They recognize the brutal reality that we're broke. And you're seeing that. We just talked in the last segment about the state level, and it certainly applies here. We've seen record deficits, and the budget that the president introduced this past week just continues to put the pedal to the metal. So, I mean, we're talking about this year alone, we're at a $1.5 trillion deficit. And, we talk about draconian measures of the CR, but that draconian is leaving our children with debt that smothers
right.
them.
But in the real world, what happens if this doesn't get past the Senate or past the president? Then what?
Well, look, I'm not naive to the fact that when it goes to the Senate, they're going to make their changes and then it's got to go to the president. So it will not be in the form that we produced yesterday morning at 5 a.m. When we left the House, being on the floor all
so
night.
So you're prepared for maybe half that figure?
Well, I'm interested. I'm eager to see what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't expect it's going to be in the same form that we produced yesterday morning.
Where is this going, George? Everybody, of course, talks about government shutdown, or not. Some do.
Well, that's premature. The Democratic senators have to decide, as does the president, whether they want to spend the next 2 years blocking in the Senate or vetoing on the president's desk spending bills because they're too small, because they believe the government isn't spending enough. The Democratic senators have to decide if out of a $15 trillion economy, the economy is going to be hurt by cutting $60 billion from the federal budget. They have to decide whether out of a $3.7 trillion budget, there isn't $60 billion of inessential spending.
But it's still the hugest proposed cut. Who's going to blink first on it? And you've been briefed. I know you've been talking to leadership about these matters.
This is very difficult, and we all recognize that we have to begin to cut spending. As Jonathan mentioned, the House Democrats, the Senate Democrats, the president has submitted a budget, the 2012 budget, that will slow the rate of growth and bring down the federal deficit to 3% of GDP by 2015. Yeah, President Obama has a little bit of fiscal conservatism in him. But the point is that this is primal scream politics. $61 billion at the current spending levels is draconian. It cuts essential, vital, necessary services. George, it's people, it's students who are in college right now with Pell Grants that will have to face significant cuts. It's preschoolers and Head Starts that may not be able to go to school on the morning after May 4th if we don't continue with the continuing resolution at 2010 levels. So I think this is draconian. It's bad for the country. It's bad for the economy, and it slows down economic growth at a time when things are finally moving up.
And John, do you think it's going to lead to a shutdown?
Well, it might. I think there's a real possibility of that. I can tell you this. John Boehner has been telling people privately, his Republican colleagues, that he will not allow a government shutdown. But the question is, will he be able to, to produce? Here's the timeline, though, is that they just did this. The House and the Senate are gone for the next week. They have 4 days when they get back to work out some kind of an agreement. And if they don't do it by the end of the 4 days, we are at a government shutdown.
So what's going to happen? What sort of pressure are you going to put on the speaker?
Well, I think the Republicans, we have no desire to have a government shutdown. I think that Speaker Boehner has been very, very clear. I think that he wanted to produce a bill that was legitimate. We saw over the last 5 days, we saw the first CR that went through open rules. We had over 500 amendments. We voted on 70, and it was amazing to see the process, to see Democrats voting with Republicans on amendments. I mean, the will of the floor
but
was
heard.
But are
your colleagues going to go along with something that doesn't cut spending? Even
it's going to have to cut spending. I mean, we're going to have to cut spending.
But the appropriation chair came up with $30 billion in spending cuts, and then the House, the ultra-conservatives, I have no other way of describing you, you guys decided that you needed $30 billion more.
The politics of a shutdown, it sunk Newt Gingrich. Would it sink Speaker Boehner?
It would not do anyone any good on either side. But our viewers can do the arithmetic. They can take $60 billion from $3.7 trillion, and if that's draconian, what wouldn't be draconian?
But, George, we're talking about over the next 7 months. We got food safety workers that will be impacted. We have
budget,
people who will be impacted across the board.
This budget includes $7,500 bribes for anyone who will buy a Chevrolet
and
Volt.
And that arithmetic will be...
the Metro. We're going to need to get the bicycle out, George.
You can carry on your challenges in the green room, where the roundtable will continue. In the Middle East overnight, the popular uprisings sweeping the region have taken their most violent turn yet. It happened in Libya. Protesters there have been calling for the removal of the strongman Muammar Gaddafi for the last 5 days. He's been in power for more than 40 years, and eyewitnesses are reporting that the military has now been firing on protesters after gaining their confidence and being welcomed into the crowd. A doctor gave a dramatic radio interview. Let's listen.
Oh, my God. They are firing at the civilians here. They are crazy. They are going crazy here.
There are reports of hundreds dead and thousands injured in Libya. In Yemen this morning, thousands marched again in the streets of the capital, Sana'a. The president, an important American ally in the war on terror, blamed the unrest on a foreign plot. And in Bahrain, home to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet, which protects crucial oil shipping lanes, demonstrators retook the square where their calls for reform have now given way to calls for the king to step down. Bahrain, of course, is also a logistical hub and command center for U.S. operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. And last night, in a 180-degree turn, the Crown Prince offered to open up a dialogue with the protesters. ABC's Miguel Marquez is there.
Christiane, it is amazing the difference that 24 hours makes. This time yesterday, this country appeared poised for civil war. Now it is a celebration down here at Pearl Square, as you can see, and it appears we're headed for a negotiated political settlement. In order to get the settlement they want, these protesters are now willing to stay for the long haul. You can see they've set up tents all the way around Pearl Square here. They're even serving food out here. That tea, by the way, is called Freedom Tea, and they are very organized. This area over here is the men's section, and then right back here, all these people in black, that's the women's section. The big question is, what will get these protesters to go home? They want a constitutional democracy. They want the king to back off of politics and become a figurehead. They want the prime minister, who's been in power for 40 years, to go home. But so much blood has been spilled here in the past week. These protesters want a significant deal. Will they get it? It's not clear. It's not clear what will get them to stop protesting, pack up their tents, and go home. Christiane?
And we'll keep watching Bahrain and the other uprisings. President Obama has called Bahrain's king. He did that on Friday, urging him to respect the rights of the protesters. The administration once again finds itself in a bit of a bind as freedom activists face off against an authoritarian ally. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton walked a fine line when I spoke to her exclusively on Friday.
Madam Secretary, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
About Bahrain, how do you assess Bahrain right now? Is it stable?
You know, Christiane, we've been very clear from the beginning that we do not want to see any violence. We deplore it. We think it is absolutely unacceptable. We very much want to see the human rights of the people protected, including right to assemble, right to express themselves, and we want to see reform. And so Bahrain had started on some reform, and we want to see them get back to that as quickly as possible.
What will the United States do, and will it hold Bahrain to a similar standard as it did Egypt?
We try to hold everyone to a similar standard, but we cannot dictate the outcomes. We cannot tell countries what they're going to do. We had, you know, no control over what happened in Egypt.
As Americans sit and watch and try to make sense of what's going on in the Arab Muslim world, is what's happening, is the emerging new order, is it good for America? What should Americans make of it?
Well, I think in general, Americans are in favor of human rights, freedom, democracy. We know that ultimately the most progress that can be made on behalf of human beings anywhere is when those individuals are empowered, when they have governments that are responsive. That's what we want to see. At the same time, we recognize that this process can be hijacked. It can be hijacked by both outside and inside elements within any country. I mean, what a tragedy to see what happened in Iran. There was a great deal of hope and pent-up feeling that the time had come in 1979, and look at what Iran is doing today.
You want democracy. You speak about democracy. Can you control democracy? Should you control democracy, or do you have to take the chips and let them fall where they may if you want democracy?
Well, I think that first we have to start from the basic premise as to what democracy means. And democracy is not one election that then whoever wins it decides never to have another one. That is not what anyone wants. We want to work with those forces within societies that are yearning for change to make sure that they have the support needed, and frankly, the technical assistance, the financial assistance, to be able to make it through to what is a good outcome, what they've asked for in their online blogs and in their posters and in their interviews.
I want to ask you this because it's an in-depth interview that you've done in Bazaar. It's a beautiful layout. I'm struck by the imagery, though. You are there, beautiful, but in a corner.
You know what? I just do what photographers tell me to do.
Right.
It has no metaphorical meaning for me.
So I want to ask you, do you feel in a corner right now or on a tightrope trying to balance the need for stability in the countries where you have allies and interests and your values, wanting democracy and all the human rights for the people there? Is that a struggle?
Well, I think it is a challenge, and it is a challenge not only at this point of time in the Middle East. It is an inherent challenge in diplomacy, in America's efforts in the world. We want to advance our security, our values, and our interests. And if there were one template that could be imposed on every situation, I wouldn't need to have this job, and nobody else would have to either. But this is often a balancing act.
And do you feel you're at a turning point, at a sort of a tectonic shift in trying to figure out where the balance is, where your strategic interests lie?
Well, Christiane, we deal with, you know, so many countries around the world, some of whom are closer to our values, who see their interests in ways we do, and some of whom are on the opposite end of the spectrum.
In the Middle East, America's strategic interests have been with some of these autocratic rulers. They've helped you with Israel and peace in the region. They've helped you against terrorism. Do you believe that a democratic people could be a force for much more stability, longer-term stability?
Well, ultimately, a really truly functioning, comprehensive democracy has historically been proven to be a greater force for stability. Navigating through what are difficult choices for societies that are doing that transition is something that the United States encourages, as we did after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and will continue to encourage.
Will you be encouraging it here?
Well, we have been, but at the same time, we are also knowledgeable enough about historical experiences to know that This is not an easy journey for any people to make. There are many threats and problems along the way.
It is beyond dispute that the Obama administration scaled back their democracy and freedom agenda of the Bush administration. In Egypt, the funds for NGOs and the like, civil society, democracy building, were cut back, and furthermore, were directed, when they were directed, to NGOs that were supported by the Mubarak regime. Was that a mistake?
Well, first of all, I just reject the premise. I think that there is...
It's indisputable.
Well, it's not. That's just not the case. There were differences in approach under the same set of goals to try to promote democracy, economic opportunity, women's rights, labor organizing. There are many different ways that I think all of us, different administrations, different experts, have struggled with. There is no debate that for 30 years, Republican and Democratic administrations alike sent the same message to President Mubarak and the regime that they had to change. And we were all trying different ways. You know, I think it's fair to say that none of us were particularly successful because we kept running into an absolute rejection that was not going to be done in Egypt. But we tried many different approaches, and we're going to try many different approaches in different settings as well.
The State Department just had an Arabic Twitter account, a Farsi Twitter account this week. What do you expect to do with that?
Have you been following the Farsi Twitter account?
I'm following it all.
Excellent, excellent. Well, what we expect to do is to be communicating through the new social media with literally millions of people around the world, because we want them to hear directly from us what our policies are. We want to use it to rebut some of the falsehoods and accusations that unfortunately are made against the United States. But mostly, we want to be in the mix with this incredible young, energetic population that is seeking the same rights to express themselves as young people in the United States seek.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
As we now know, behind the wave of uprisings in the Middle East is a generation of educated, internet-savvy young Arab professionals and their weapons, social media, mostly made in America, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook. In the darkest days of the protests in Egypt, two anonymous activists kept the online movement alive. This week, they agreed to tell us the gripping story of their fight for freedom, which was not with tanks, but with tech. Incredibly, one of the key players in the online youth movement that helped bring down Hosni Mubarak was a 34-year-old Egyptian-American who never left Washington.
I had contacts on the ground. People were asking me to get messages to them. People would turn to me and be like, what should we do? And I'd be like, well, I don't know. I've never started a revolution before.
A year ago, Nadine Wahab connected online with the young Google marketing executive and anti-government activist Wael Qonim.
They're basically a bunch of thugs, thieves, and, you know, who've been ruining our country. They're so 1970, and we are so 2010.
They'd been trying to mobilize demonstrations through Facebook since June of last year. And at first, the protest was small. But on January 25th, they posted this page calling for a protest that mushroomed into a full-scale revolt. How? A week earlier, not so far away in Tunisia, young people had forced out their authoritarian president. They had also taken advantage of an explosion of social media that in just the last 4 years has electrified the Arab and Muslim world. Is this explosion of technology, the access among so many people, is this the reason for these revolutions and uprisings that are going on, the turmoil?
It's a planning tool and an organizing tool.
Bobby Ghosh has been reporting on the youth movement for this week's Time magazine and says it's been key to spreading revolutionary fervor.
So Tunisians can talk to Egyptians. Egyptians can talk to Yemenis. And it shows them that they're not alone.
Arab satellite television also played a role. Electrified by what happened in Tunis, young Egyptians used Facebook to call for a protest in Tahrir Square.
I put out an event and say, if 100,000 people confirm in 3 days, then I'm going to take this seriously and, you know, try and make it 1 million.
Wael Ghonim blogged anonymously. So did his friend, Ahmed Salah, a young lawyer. And they exchanged key tactical advice online.
On pages, on personal accounts, on groups, that have very specific instructions from Tunisians to Egyptians. And so it gives you instructions on how to deal with the tear gas, on how to deal with the police generally, what times of the day is better for you to go to the street, how to deal with rubber bullets.
The Facebook page became their corner cafe, the place to meet, to recruit and share ideas.
One of the ideas that we're still trying to trace where it had originated was the idea to go to popular areas and bring people from the popular areas to specific public squares.
After a week of protest, the Mubarak regime shut down the internet. Wael was arrested, but he had already made a plan to preserve the online movement.
In case he disappears or anything, I should take over the page. If he's arrested, it's very expected that he would be investigated and tortured. So if the page had stopped working at the time, that would be sort of incriminating for him.
Half a world away, Nadine had set up a makeshift war room in a DC townhouse.
When the internet went down is when my world sort of turned topsy-turvy. It became surreal.
They were determined to keep the page up and running.
People would tell me, Nadine, they're not going to come for you here. But I was terrified. When I was at night by myself, I was terrified.
At the same time in Cairo, Ahmed also continued the work Wael had started.
When I wake up either early in the morning, I post five or six posters or as many as I could in a very short time, a couple of hours. And then I post one sentence that says, I'm going to Tahrir.
But even they were stunned when Wael was released and Hosni Mubarak stepped aside.
I'm proud to be an Egyptian since 25th. I've seen all these, you know, heroes on the street doing all these things that I never thought Egyptians would do. And, you know, in 15 days, Egyptians learned what does it mean to me to involve in politics and call for their rights.
That moment emboldened a movement across the Middle East, filled with young people who now believe they can break the grip of repressive regimes, armed with something as simple as a cell phone.
How wired is the whole region?
It's quite substantially wired. Even people who you would say are quite poor and live in the old city and 20 people to a small home, they have a cell phone that it'll have a camera if they can afford it. It'll have a sort of email service or an internet connection.
In Bahrain, the protesters in Pearl Square have makeshift charging stations for that vital weapon against oppression.
It plays a big role, okay, in gathering people and giving them instructions, go here, don't go there, okay? This place is dangerous. Don't try to attack policemen.
In Yemen, Ala Jaban is helping to mobilize young people by posting a few simple photos on Facebook.
Those people who go out to demonstrate, especially young people, are out there just to ask the better for their countries and ask for their rights.
Thousands turned out and forced their president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, to take back his plan to make himself president for life. Watching this wave reach its borders, Saudi Arabia is desperately trying to contain it. It set up a Facebook page where the chief of the royal court encourages you to post your complaint directly. And if you fax it in, they guarantee a response within 24 hours. In Iran, despite the government's attempts to block it, 90% of the hits on this Facebook page still come from Iran.
The people who are doing this, are these people who are friendly to the United States?
They're suspicious of the United States, most of them, their entire lives. But they're not viscerally anti-American. We're not seeing American flags being burnt. We're not seeing the American president or Hillary Clinton being hung in effigy. And so if the U.S. is able to conduct some smart diplomacy, I think it's possible to get over that hump of suspicion that they have.
The Egyptian revolution wasn't driven just by the internet and its super users like Wael, Nadine and Ahmed, but by forces that have sparked revolutions throughout history. the fight for basic freedoms that connect us all.
The experience and the inspiration has no borders.
It was much bigger than any of us, and it showed a different model other than violence. You saw a people come together in a way that was just wonderful.
The dream became true, and you know, whatever we have been fighting for since the 25th of January is now being realized.
And I'll continue to follow the unfolding events in the Middle East in real time on Twitter and on my blog, my Facebook page, or at abcnews.com. That's it for our program this week. Stay with ABC News and abcnews.com for all the very latest on the uprisings in the Middle East and the budget crisis here in Washington and around the country. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you again next week.